From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Another round down in the fight for the Democratic nomination, and John Kerry continues to build his lead. But John Edwards is still nipping at his heels, and if next month is anything like the last month, anything can happen. Electability is the big buzzword, but that means different things to different people. Tonight on Point, who are these guys? Vision, character, and the battle for the Democratic nomination. The next round in the nomination race is on Saturday when caucus goers pick their man in Michigan and Washington State. Joining me now from Seattle, Washington, for a look ahead is David Postman, chief political reporter for the Seattle Times. Good evening and welcome, David Postman.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. So we understand it's Kerry and Dean in Washington State. Didn't you guys get the memo?
Yeah, no, apparently not. We're a little behind the curve, as we seem to always be in these things.
Is it a real contest between these two at this point, yeah. David?
Yeah, it looks like it. I would say those are the two main contenders. Dean was organized first out here and best, really, for a long time. Had the support of the party chairman, the former party chair, party executive directors, those sorts of people all went to Dean early. And as was the case elsewhere, when it looked like Dean was the inevitable nominee, it certainly looked like he would win Washington. Kerry, though, never abandoned the state and had a staff here even before he won in Iowa. It's been important to him. He, after Iowa, moved a whole busload of staff here. So I think he wanted this early and saw things out here that might work well for him.
We'll talk about Kerry's effort there, but what about Dean? Is it something about the Washington State electorate that's going to hang in with this pugnacious, tough-spoken candidate, even when he's not getting great raves in other states?
Yeah, great raves in other states don't mean anything here. He spoke, I think, most directly to people here with that anti-war stuff that he started with, and strong anti-war sentiments, particularly in the Seattle area here. There's also just a sense in past caucuses that Democrats like, and Republicans too, for that matter, like the maverick. They went for Paul Tsongas, Gary Hart, Jesse Jackson placed second here. And so folks can do well here who might not be seen on the stage again after Washington. So the predictive value is questionable.
On the other hand, if Howard Dean makes a good showing in Washington State, he will obviously crow about that all across the country. What are the polls showing? Is he within range of John Kerry? Is he still ahead?
Well, we haven't actually seen any polls, believe it or not. We may be the one place that so far doesn't. The party chairman told me yesterday he hadn't yet to see one poll.
You're very laid back out there, David.
Well, part of it is that the way the caucus works, we don't have party registration mm-hmm. in the state, so mm-hmm. it's hard to even identify who's going to go, and the party and the candidates really struggle with that. So to do a meaningful poll is difficult. I hear there is one now in the field, so we might see something, but I haven't. But, yeah, Dean certainly has a chance still to win here. You know, you said if he does well, he'll crow. I mean, if he does well, he'll crow. He has to win, I think, in order to crow, given his advantage here for so long.
And given that he hasn't won anywhere yet.
Right. And the natural connection to people in Seattle and Washington State and his ties with the party officials, if he doesn't win here, I think it just looks really, really bad for him. And some of his supporters have, you know, said, this is a must win. You know, Dean hates that. He said there is no such thing except for that day in Boston
right.
in the summer. But if he can't win here, where? That's the question.
And how has John Kerry been chipping away at that Dean position? What's been the line? Or is it simply him standing there looking presidential and talking about or emanating electability, whatever that is?
Yeah, I think there certainly was some of that early on. And he has great connections, obviously, in the veterans community. There's a strong vet population. In Washington State, we have a lot of military bases around the area, so he plugs into that pretty well. He's been endorsed by the League of Conservation Voters, the National Environmental Group. The environment is often number one issue for Democratic voters, or at least in the top couple for Democratic voters. And LCV is working hard here to organize him. So he has a couple of those sorts of issues over and above looking tall and presidential. But I think that part of it for him here is just that it is everywhere. As Dean falters, here's this guy who is slow and steady but still standing up straight.
Well, David Postman, we'll be watching closely to see what the unpredictable Washington State voters do this weekend. We'll check in with you again. Thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
You bet, anytime.
David Postman, chief political reporter for the Seattle Times. He spoke with me from Seattle, Washington. We are talking tonight about the battle of visions, images and hopes playing out in the Democratic Party right now. Democrats, are you getting what you want, what you need from this primary race? Are you fired up yet? Republicans, are you seeing a real contender here or not? And primary voters, did you date Dean and marry Kerry? Are you thinking of having an affair with Edwards? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Brooklyn is New York, is Philip Gravich, Washington correspondent for The New Yorker magazine. His piece in this week's issue is Shakeout, Reversals of Fortune in a High-Stakes Race. He is the author of We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed with Our Family, Stories from Rwanda. Good evening and welcome, Philip Gravich.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Philip, you've written, you've spent time with these campaigns. You've watched these men, and you've written with wonderful insight about all these candidates. What do you make of the showings last night? Did it line up with the expectations you built spending some time with them on the campaign trail?
Well, I think it certainly lined up with the expectations created by the previous contests in Iowa and New Hampshire. The big surprise, obviously, in this so far was Iowa caucus night, when months and months of predictions that basically we were looking at a battle for first place between Dean and Gephardt, with sort of a struggle for third between Kerry and Edwards, perhaps, was completely upended. And Gephardt dropped out that mm-hmm. very night, or as a result of that night, the mm-hmm. next morning. Mm-hmm. Dean came in a dismal third, and you had Kerry really very far out front, someone who had been predicted to be completely stagnant and moribund, his campaign, just a couple weeks earlier. I mean, it's quite interesting. If you're, for instance, cleaning your house and you happen to come across some old newspapers, to take a look at what was going on a week or 10 days before that.
No kidding, they're still in the pile.
Incredibly confident tone of not pundits, but reporters. Mm-hmm. And just describing as sort of a matter of fact, the steamroller.
This is the way it is.
This is how it is. Dean's on his way. Kerry is toast. The guys in between, who knows? You know, Gephardt is the one wild card in Iowa. And once you had that really quite surprising and dramatic reversal of fortune, then New Hampshire was where that got ratified. Even a day before the Iowa vote, in New Hampshire what you saw was Dean still out front. And I think that the polls the morning after Iowa were still showing Dean in the lead. And again, he got trounced by Kerry there. And so it was that really made Kerry had this tremendous momentum and this tremendous sense of going forward coming into yesterday's primaries and caucuses. And I think that was pretty much the question was only yesterday, is he going to win all seven? Is he going to win five? Is he going to win four?
Will it be a sweep or something else?
Mm-hmm. Will anybody else win more than one?
Mm-hmm.
That
right.
was the biggest question,
right.
I
right.
think.
Philip Gravich, it's fascinating to us as this thing barrels forward, and particularly after the big surprise in Iowa, how quickly the horse race really takes over. The issues kind of recede, and it's persona that comes to the fore so powerfully. It may be two-dimensional persona representations of these candidates, but you've spent some time with them, and I wish you'd share a little bit of your insight with us from that time and look at what it is about each of these guys who are still in the race and the way that they're hitting the electorate that's producing the outcomes we're seeing. Just sit with us and John Kerry for a minute here. Talk about the man, how he projects, what you've seen on the campaign trail, and how it appears to be playing out to the electorate.
Well, the puzzle with John Kerry is that he was not winning anything like a personality contest along the way. He is a man with a certain air of distance about him. He's obviously got this patrician quality, and even in his speech and his personal presence and affect, he's not somebody who kind of comes across as a regular guy or one of you to the, I don't know, the farmers of Iowa,
right.
or the former mill workers of New Hampshire.
You write quite wonderfully that you say John Kerry's long, angular face has something of the abstraction of a tribal mask.
Oh, he really, you know, I've watched him. Now, obviously, when he's really having a great time at a rally, he starts to light up. But if you're sitting in a room with him, talking to him, nothing moves but his mouth. It's very flat and it's very still. He has very small eyes. That's a physical description.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of something about him, there he doesn't give off a lot of warmth or kind of immediacy, and at the same time he does give off obviously this kind of solidity and steadiness that people have been responding to.
A kind of augustness, but now he's in the front. What put him there, and will that persona keep him there? Will it carry him?
Well, it seems to be that it, I mean, first of all, I think one has seen that in November and December, John Kerry, who had been seen at the beginning of the race to be, you know, sort of the inevitable front runner, when he first declared, he seemed like the best candidate.
Way back when, a year ago and more.
That's right. It was his turn, almost. And then he got so badly received for a long time. He was taking a tremendous beating, and he didn't look like he was having much fun with it. And he clearly wasn't having fun. He was down. He looked down. He sounded down. There was a kind of lifelessness to the thing. He has responded to his surge, I think, very, very well, which is to say that he doesn't look like the same guy bouncing up. He looks like a guy thoroughly rejuvenated bouncing up. And as he gets all of this support, and he gets bigger crowds, and there's an enthusiasm for him, he returns that, and he feeds off it, and he feeds it at the same time. And I think one of the things that struck me is, although on some level he seems the most distant of these characters, I noticed time and again that at his campaign events, he manages, by gathering people around him on the stage, whether it's war veterans or whether it's his own family members, whether it's Teddy Kennedy carrying on, or whether it's somebody else testifying about his qualities, to create sort of the most emotion in a room.
It's interesting. Many Americans quailed at the thought of 4 years of Al Gore being president, watching that stiff former vice president. I mean, lots of people voted for him, but even with some misgivings about that experience of the intimacy that we feel en masse with a president who's in our living rooms on the television. How do you think John Kerry will come across when Americans think, do I want to sit and look at this man for 4 years, to you know, will I be warmed? Will I be inspired? Will I be encouraged by his face?
Well, you know, you mentioned earlier, just this, as you raised this sort of question, the fact that as one gets to this crunch time and decision time and the very accelerated pace of a primary, like the primary schedule like we're seeing, issues fall by the way in terms of being debated in their nitty-gritty, and it really comes down to some sort of a gut feeling. This is something that I was told time and again by campaign workers, staffers, handlers, the people really close to candidates who've worked. But interestingly, it's something that Kerry himself said. Now, it might have sounded a little bit self-serving, except that this is a guy who really can't claim that everywhere he goes, people just, you know, sort of...
That they love him naturally, right.
Say, you know, my gut tells me you're my man.
Right.
This has taken him a long time to establish, but he says, in the end, what people are looking for is a kind of confidence. And this is a man who's playing very strongly, not off the idea that I'm going to win you because you find me the warmest, most likable sort of family member type guy, or the guy next door, or the guy who you can sort of confide in. I'm going to be your man because I am a war hero of a certain kind, which is to say I was a commander who had the respect of his men, who protected his men, who defended his men, who stood for them in combat, and then afterwards came out of combat and stood against the war because he thought it was wrong while he defended the men who were fighting it. Mm. And that's really what he's playing up very, 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 very much. That's his message. And I think it's important to understand that the man whose life he saved in Vietnam showed up 2 days before the Iowa caucus and saved his life politically, as it were, by saying, I'm a former Republican. I was under fire with John Kerry in Vietnam. He turned around under fire and came back to rescue me. He saved my life. That's the kind of person he is. I've watched him all these years. He's never been in my party, but this is the campaign I support. And I think that was, you can't really overstate how powerful that was at that moment in making this man who in some ways seemed remote seem real as a leader.
Philip Gravitz, we've just got 10 seconds before the break. Your gut feeling, can John Edwards at this point flip John Kerry, or is it too late?
I think it's tough. I think it's very tough, just simply in terms of sheer momentum and the fact that up till now, he's only won the state he was born in.
We're talking tonight about the men at the top of the Democratic primary race and the battle of visions and personalities playing out now across the country. Our guest is Philip Gurevich, Washington correspondent for The New Yorker magazine. You can join the conversation tonight. Democrats, are you getting what you want, what you need from this primary season? And Republicans, do you see a real contender out there for the White House? Do you see more than one? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the men at the top of the Democratic primary race and the battle of visions and images there playing out across the country right now. My guest tonight is Philip Gurevich. He's Washington correspondent for The New Yorker magazine. He's been traveling with the candidates and writing intimately about their personalities, the way they project, what they bring to the whole contest that everybody's watching so closely right now. You can join our conversation tonight. What's driving the Democrats' challenge this year? Is it issues or anger? And is there a difference this year? Did you date Dean and marry Kerry? Are you thinking about an affair with Edwards? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Nate's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Nate. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Great,
thanks.
Thanks
for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to say to Philip, I thought he was right on the mark, obviously, with the way that Kerry rejuvenated himself by calling out that fellow that he saved. I think that was a great thing.
Well, the fellow came to him all the better, right?
Yeah. I guess the point I wanted to make, or I just wanted to ask the question, I guess, as much as anything, you had just highlighted, do you think that John Edwards has a chance to overtake Kerry? And I think throughout the campaign, I've been interested to note that, you know, perhaps why hasn't anybody said, does Wes Clark have a chance to overtake Kerry, having finished first in Oklahoma and second in Arizona, New Mexico, and North Dakota? And I think that he offers a really fresh perspective. And I think overall, the media has largely looked beyond him, especially just after the primaries on Tuesday. It now seems as if they're trying to act like it is a two-person race. And I think that Wes Clark has been doing quite well. And I guess I'm curious to see or hear from you guys why you think he's maybe not been talked about as much as Kerry and Edwards.
We'll pick it straight up, Nate. Thanks for your call. Philip Gurevich, what about it? We've got plenty to talk about here, but Wes Clark, Nate says, not getting the attention he deserves, certainly from the media, he says. What do you think?
Well, you know, Wes Clark really came into the race, I think, very late, as somebody with no political experience whatsoever. And he came in, it seems to me, as a sort of counterinsurgent to the Dean insurgency. He was basically saying, I too am anti-war, but I've got the military experience that makes me electable. And that was his position. I mean, he was running on his resume, and he was running on that line. And in terms of trying to make himself simultaneously to known to voters and to map out a set of positions, he made a whole lot of fumbles along the way. And one ended up with the feeling along the way that he really didn't know himself, how to present himself, what he stood for, as fully as one needs to feel, especially from somebody who doesn't have a record in this kind of public life to look at.
They've got to come across particularly commandingly in some sense, I guess.
The fact that he commanded NATO doesn't necessarily have a lot of oomph for American voters who are trying to figure out how to confront the choice. And the choice right now for Democrats, I think, is twofold. One is, it's not that policy isn't on their minds. It's that overall the differences in policy, with some exceptions, particularly about tax policy, between all of these candidates has not been that extreme, and it's certainly been significantly less than any choice between any of them and the Republican ticket. So they're looking at, who is it that I want to have in some way embody, personify, and represent the party or the alternative to Bush and go forward and beat Bush? And this is what people mean by electability. They mean somebody who can beat Bush. And they look at Wes Clark and they say, he's not tried, he's not experienced, he doesn't have the breadth, frankly, of experience, I think is what one keeps hearing.
And does that show up? Do you feel that in the room when Wes Clark speaks? Does it come
he's
straight across?
He's a very uneven speaker. I followed him around in the South when he did a tour just before New Year's through about 10 southern cities in 2 days. And he broke out on that trip what became basically a stump speech, which is a very good speech in many ways. And when he gave it well and he had a good crowd that was responding well, he was really quite lively, and he really struck chords. And there were actually the strongest things in it, I thought, were his several of his points about sort of trying to reclaim the language of patriotism, faith, and family values from the Republicans and say, wait, you can't take my flag and my patriotism away from me. And moreover, you can't talk about trying to browbeat me with religion when you don't seem to practice what you preach. And I thought those were very strong lines, but that's not what people in some way are looking for when they're saying, can this guy go the distance against Bush?
So great lines in areas where he's got credibility, but maybe not what people are voting on. Philip Gurevich, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Susan Page. She's Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Good evening and welcome, Susan Page.
Good evening. morning, Tom.
Thanks for joining us, Susan. I'm sure you were watching last night and listening along with everyone else. Sitting this morning, I mean, the Democrats can get very excited about the House party that's going on. When you look outside the party at the general election challenge here, do you see candidates coming to the fore who have the stuff, who have the persona, the issues, the image that can go the distance, Susan?
Well, that's, of course, the question that you hear every time you talk to a Democratic voter in Iowa or New Hampshire or South Carolina, because that's really what voters are looking for and what has propelled Senator Kerry so far, I think. When you look at national polls, you certainly see the potential for a very competitive race this fall. President Bush certainly has vulnerabilities that could be exploited. You don't know, I guess, until you get farther along in the process if Democrats will be able to do that effectively. But certainly one of the calculations I think Democratic voters are making is that Senator Kerry has 4 terms in the Senate, experience in national security affairs as a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and from his tours of duty in Vietnam, and that they're making the calculation that he can face up to Bush. In the latest USA Today CNN Gallup poll, which we published in Tuesday's paper, it showed Senator Kerry beating President Bush in a head-to-head matchup outside the margin of error, beating him by 7 points, which is a significant lead. Now, that's a snapshot in time. Doesn't mean it'll be that way next week or 6 months from now, but it certainly shows the potential for a close race.
And the same question I'll put to you that I put to Philip Gravich. John Edwards, strong showing in South Carolina yesterday, a strong showing in Oklahoma, and a rapid ascent in recent weeks. Is there a scenario in which he could flip John Kerry here and take the lead?
I think it's too early to rule that out. You know, we've only had 3 weeks of voting, and Kerry has only about 11% of the convention delegates he needs. There's a long way to go. I think there is certainly time for John Kerry to stumble, to make a mistake, and for a candidate, John Edwards would be the most likely one, to connect with voters to kind of catch on fire the way candidates sometimes do.
We've got to come back and talk a little more about Howard Dean here as well, but let's get a caller first. Ed's calling from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Philip. Hi, Susan.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I wanted to raise a point. Prior to this election race, I've never really participated in politics too much. However, this, in light of what's happened in the economy in the last few years, has pretty much incited me to, mm-hmm. to take an active stance. What interests me most is that Kerry, being the front runner now, seems to be beyond reach of any other Democratic candidate insofar as reproach goes. And by that, I mean I have a signed document with John Kerry and Edward Kennedy's signature on it, urging union labor, even specifically stating that they don't see the need for any labor other than union labor, where that really doesn't speak to the working man, it being only 20% of the workforce today. None of these things seem to be coming up anymore after Iowa and New Hampshire, whereby the Democratic candidates accomplished their goal of taking Dean down, not one or two, but maybe 3 or 4 notches overall in the race. But it doesn't seem to be – nobody seems to be in a position to turn their tide.
Ed, may I ask you, did Howard Dean draw you into the political arena this year, and are you feeling some sour grapes that he's had a tough ride now?
In fact, he did for one reason, Tom, and that happens to be, number one, as a governor, he's accomplished a lot that you can say maybe might mirror closely running a country. I don't know specifically. I don't have any experience. But as far as my perspective goes, a lot of people just seem to be jumping on the bandwagon. The media is having this tremendous effect, replaying his scream and his shout, trying almost in successfully doing so, influencing the behavior of the American public, where people really aren't thinking for themselves. They're looking at it in an electability fashion, but there are a lot of skeletons in John Kerry's closet, and whether because of the media or not, a lot of these things aren't coming out now.
Ed, let us pick that up, and thanks very much for your call. Philip Gravich, how about that? That's the second caller who's come in with a kind of gritted teeth about the way the media has handled their candidate. How do you see the way the echo chamber of the media has treated these candidates? Did the media create Howard Dean as the front runner? Did they knock him off his horse in Iowa?
Well,
is it the electorate or the media, or what's the interaction?
I would say that it's important to remember that voters certainly did not create Howard Dean as a front runner, because since votes have been
right.
cast, he's done very poorly.
Mm.
And the role of the press in amplifying his candidacy and hyping him, it was enormous. I mean, this is a man who benefited tremendously from being on the covers of a great number of the main Newsweekly magazines,
sure.
Some of them more than once, mm-hmm. over a course of several months, being basically described as the front runner. And one really didn't hear Howard Dean supporters complaining at that stage.
They were looking for a momentum play that they'd roll right through.
Scrutiny. They felt that was honest scrutiny. And the fact is, most of it was about the fact that he was a great fundraiser.
Susan Page, I hear you there.
I was going to say that actually I think the press was a little slow to pick up on the connection that Dean was making. I think he was sort of a political phenomenon that took us a while to catch on to. But I did want to say one thing that struck me about the caller's point. Kerry has been lucky in the timing of his emergence as a front runner. You know, Dean was a front runner. He got tremendous press scrutiny, which he hadn't had before. He was attacked on all sides by the other candidates in the debates. Mm-hmm. Very tough ads against him in Iowa. When Kerry emerged as a front runner, Dean, because of the repercussions from that negative campaigning, I think was reluctant to go after Kerry in the same way he had gone after Gephardt. John Edwards has made a big point about running a positive campaign. So I think that Kerry has escaped some of the battering that Howard Dean faced when he was at the front of the pack.
And maybe the tone in the room now is it's not the time to batter so hard on the front runner. He may be our candidate soon.
There's that, and there's also it's not going to serve me, an alternative candidate, to beat him up either.
It's also important to remember that Howard Dean was running against the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
He was running against anybody who'd ever had a time spent in Washington, and he continues to say, basically, like, if you've been in Washington, you're disqualified from my idea of somebody who can be good for this country.
But in fairness, he seemed to rev this whole season up like nobody else. It seems that all the candidates owe him a big debt of gratitude.
Absolutely. And yet that debt of gratitude has a sort of time limitation on it in terms of how they see it. I think they see him as he definitely put a lot of spark into this race early on and challenged people. And you know, when he says they hijacked my message, well, everybody always takes over the message that there's a response from. And you can hear Howard Dean filtered through much of what one's hearing as the mainstream message now. But he continues to run against the party. And I think that's part of why it's hard for him now to get traction as an attacker.
There's more to say about Howard Dean. We're going to have to devote a whole hour to him one evening and that whole phenom. Stan's calling from Mercer, Wisconsin. Hi, Stan. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. This is kind of a comment question with a projection, if you'll allow me.
Okay, go for it.
I've heard a lot of talk on public radio, and I listen to it all day long, about how angry the people are and how angry the Democrats are and all this here.
Yeah.
And yet this very station about a week ago, I don't remember what show, did a call-in poll, and Bush won about 2-1, hands down. And what I think, my projection is that Bush is sitting on about $102 million, supposedly.
It's a lot of money.
And I think he's just laughing, and he's going to wait till the last month, and then he's going to use that $102 million to dig out all the skeletons into all the closets of the Democrats, and he's going to just walk right into the White House.
And, Stan, would you welcome that outcome or not?
No, I'm not for Bush, but I just this is the way I see it happening, and I think the Democrats are with all their hoopla, they're forgetting that this is a possibility. They're so enjoying their win and all that,
right.
They're forgetting that Bush is waiting in the wings.
He's waiting on the other side. Stan, thanks for your call. Susan Page, how about it? Is in the euphoria, the giddiness of primary season, have the Democrats moved into la la land here, or does that poll that you cited mean that the threat is not as great as the GOP might hope?
Yeah, it sounds like Stan should be running some campaigns for people. you know, actually, I think the biggest determinant of who wins in November is going to be something that's outside the control of either party, and that is the state of the U.S. economy and whether we're in more difficulty or less difficulty in Iraq. Maybe President Bush has some sway on that second point in particular. But, you know, the kind of jockeying we see now and the kind of strategizing and a message on health care and let's talk about jobs, those are important issues that Democrats are kind of fashioning their message on now. But we need to see what's the state of the economy, what's the unemployment rate, what's happened with job creation when it gets to the point when people are making their decisions on who to actually vote for president.
Philip Gravich, you end your article, The Shakeout, with a Democratic strategist, giving you the kind of Democrats' nightmare scenario of where party relations are going. And in fairness, it's a Republican dream. Could you describe that for us, and how real is that that possibility?
Well, I think what I have is one of the strategists for one of the campaigns just saying, you know, okay, so what happens if we don't get this right, if we don't get a candidate we can win with? Well, what we'd be looking at is Bush's a reelected Bush who doesn't have to worry about thinking about being elected again.
Mm-hmm.
He would have control of both houses of Congress as he does now, but probably with larger majorities, especially because Democrats are very concerned about the fact that four or five Democratic seats may well be lost in the Senate this year, in the South in particular.
It's a big number that would lose the filibuster margin.
Exactly. And you would have, looking at the way that redistricting has taken place in the past stretch, looking forward to more of that, making even more impregnable Republican districts, packing the courts with Republican-favored judges, and building a period of a sort of dominant Republican majority for decades. He was talking about sort of a quarter to a half a century to come, as has happened periodically in American history. How realistic is that? Well, I mean, I think that, frankly, until a month ago, the talk one heard when one talked to people even fighting very hard in these Democratic campaigns was a feeling of tremendous doom. I mean, people felt that there is this $200 million war chest in the hands of tremendously tuned Republican political fight machine, with Karl Rove obviously seen as both brilliant and ruthless, and a great sense that between the way that September 11th has played for Bush up until now, perhaps, and the ongoing and undetermined war, and the fact that the economy was having a bounce, that this was a very, very uphill race for Democrats, and that it, in some ways, is the president's to lose as much as it is for the Democrats to find somebody who can beat him. I think that sentiment is still there, but I think that it's true that in the last weeks, a mixture of a poor performance in the State of the Union, the resurgence of the WMD issue, et cetera. These things have made the president more conspicuously vulnerable at a time when also Democrats are getting the benefit of a tremendous amount of attention that comes from having a primary when the Republicans don't have one.
They sure are. Susan Page, what about that image, the Democrats moaning about the possibility of a 30 or 40-year Republican dominance on Capitol Hill? Do you hear messages, and we've just got a minute left, it's unfair, but do you hear messages of a potency from the Democrats that could push back against that, that might change the balance of rhetoric and symbolism and thought in the American political life?
Sure. I mean, absolutely. We don't tend to go all one way in this country. I mean, and the very fact that Republicans may hold clear control of Congress and the White House for a period of years will set them up to be blamed for whatever has happened by 2008. So Republicans hope that's the scenario that plays out. I guess you'd have to count me as a skeptic.
Well, a skeptic tonight, and the primaries roll on. Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief with USA Today, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Philip Gurevich, wonderful article. Wonderful to have you. Hope you'll come again. Thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Philip Gurevich, Washington correspondent for The New Yorker magazine. You can listen to our in-depth interviews with each of the remaining Democratic candidates at onpointradio.org. In a moment, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's surprising move on settlements in the Gaza Strip. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has thrown Israeli politics into an uproar this week with a pledge to pull out almost all of Israeli settlers from 17 settlements in the Gaza Strip. The move indicates a retreat from Sharon's own decades-old view that settlements protect Israel. Earlier today, Sharon said he is prepared to hold a referendum before carrying out the plan. Sharon's actions have angered settlers and those on the right, but polls show that most Israelis would support such a proposal. Harvey Morris is Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. He joins me now from Jerusalem. Good evening and welcome, Harvey Morris.
Good evening.
Harvey, how big a bombshell has this been on the Israeli political scene?
Well, it's been portrayed as a bombshell, although in fact Mr. Sharon has said basically the same sort of thing in the past, although he hasn't said categorically that he would withdraw from all settlements in Gaza. He has in the past said that Gaza is a place that, you know, will not be a homeland for Jews in the future.
So he's moving up the timetable on that. Exactly what is he proposing, Harvey? How many Jews now live in how many settlements in Gaza? How many Palestinians live there?
Well, there are about 7,500 settlers in 19 or 20 settlements, depending on how you count them, and there are 1.3 million Palestinians. the area under Israeli control, because lots of the settlements involve market garden farms, is about 40% of the territory.
So 40% of the Gaza Strip territory occupied by some 7,000 Israelis and a million plus in the remainder.
That's right, yeah.
And Prime Minister Sharon is proposing a withdrawal that would leave what portion of that abandoned or evacuated by Israelis? All of it? Nearly all of it?
The implication is if they withdraw the settlers from Gaza, eventually that territory would revert to the Palestinians, although he's not being very specific about that. In the past, he's talked about withdrawing from settlements in Gaza and leaving them as military areas under the control of the Israeli army, but it's difficult to see what logic there would be in that as part of a future settlement.
Who is protesting the Sharon proposal, and how vigorously are they protesting?
Well, naturally, the settlers are, and some of their right-wing supporters, including in Mr. Sharon's Likud party. But it has to be said that the settlement response has to be seen in the light of a certain suspicion on all sides that they don't necessarily see this as happening. I mean, Mr. Sharon has said he's planning to do it, but the timetable is very fluid, and no doubt is dependent on other factors as well.
Ariel Sharon has been a champion of settlements for many, many years. What's the rationale that he's given for this move, Harvey?
Well, I think he's also a pragmatist, and he realizes that the great mass of the Israeli population, or let's say at least a clear majority, would be in favor of a withdrawal from Gaza if it was part of a comprehensive peace settlement. So he thinks he's got the public on his side. And also, I think he's probably more concerned in maintaining Israel's presence in those areas of the West Bank which will fall to the west of the wall that's now being constructed.
But is Ariel Sharon looking at this potential withdrawal from Gaza as part of a comprehensive peace settlement, or is he looking at it as a unilateral Israeli step?
I think both. I think what's happening at the moment is that he's putting forward proposals. He's not actually taking action on the ground, but he's putting forward proposals which he would be prepared in certain circumstances to see Israel do on its own. But I think he's doing it because he wants to persuade the Palestinian side and also the Americans, who are the sponsors of the roadmap, that this is the shape of the settlement and they might as well just accept it now. And to the Palestinians in particular, he's saying, look, take what you've got on offer now because you may end up with less in the future.
We read critics of Mr. Sharon saying that this may just be a big dodge to escape the legal scrutiny that he's under right now with the bribery charges that have come against his son and are allegedly linked to the prime minister. How legitimate is that?
Well, that's true, although I don't think that he can pull a rabbit out of the hat at this stage, which will necessarily affect the legal proceedings as they get underway. It may be, however, he's got his eye on Washington because Israeli officials have been saying very confidently that he's due there at the end of this month. The Americans have been a bit more circumspect and are saying, well, yes, okay, maybe he'll come over, but we'd like to see him doing a bit more in practical terms on the ground. After all, under the roadmap, he's supposed to dismantle a number of unauthorized settlements, and I think there's a certain irritation in Washington that he's not done that. So they would like to see something practical.
Washington has also been critical of the wall or barrier that continues to go up, not along the green line of the pre-1967 border.
That's right. I mean, I think the story in a way is in the West Bank, and this plan for what might happen in Gaza at some time in the future is a slight diversion from the main issue which is there.
Harvey Morris, what's the Palestinian response been to the trial balloon Ariel Sharon has put up this week?
Well, there's been a great deal of skepticism, although the Prime Minister, Ahmed Karay, has said it's good news if it happens, and he hopes that that would lead to withdrawal from other areas. He's in a difficult position at the moment because he said that he won't have talks with Mr. Sharon unless the construction of the West Bank barrier ceases. However, he's under great pressure from Washington to get back to the negotiating table. to try and get the roadmap back on track.
Is this proposal consistent with the roadmap, Harvey Morris, or is there a new strategy emerging here that's not to do with a two-state solution, but rather Israel imposing boundaries and imposing its own solution?
That certainly has been in the air ever since Ariel Sharon, before the turn of the year, said that, you know, he would give the Palestinians a few months to fulfill their side of the roadmap. Otherwise, he would go his own way. Now, that caused a bit of nervousness in Washington because they think that rather than having unilateral steps, the way forward is to get back to the negotiating table and follow the timetable of the roadmap. So that he's got some explaining to do if he does go to Washington, to either convince the Americans that he has no partner in the Palestinian Authority, or otherwise to get some go-ahead for these unilateral steps. But at the end of the day, you know, it's difficult for either the Palestinians or the Americans to complain if he actually did withdraw from territory, which would be an essential part of the peace plan.
Harvey Morris, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Harvey Morris is Jerusalem bureau chief for the Financial Times. He spoke with me from Jerusalem. Joining me now from Paris to discuss Ariel Sharon's controversial new plan is Henry Siegman, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, where he is director of the U.S. Middle East Project. Good evening and welcome in Paris. Henry Siegman.
Good evening to you.
Thank you for joining us. Henry Siegman, how do you interpret what Ariel Sharon's up to this week with the notion of pulling all or nearly all of Israeli settlers and settlements out of the Gaza Strip? What's the big picture this is part of?
Well, as you know, and as you refer to during your talk with Mr. Morris, there's all kinds of speculation about what motivated this decision. And I think there may be a certain truth to most of those speculations, which is to say that Sharon is concerned about his personal situation and is trying to distract attention from this investigation that is creeping up on him.
Mm-hmm.
That may be part of it. He certainly has to indicate to the Israeli public that he is aware there is a serious demographic problem, and that Israel has to do something about it.
What is that demographic problem you refer to?
The demographic problem is that there is an Arab population in the combined territories of Israel and the occupied territories. If you include the Israeli Arabs, you have an Arab population that is about to be larger than the Jewish population. Jewish population is becoming a minority. That is the problem.
And when that happens, what comes in its wake? What's the concern?
When that happens, then if Israel does not grant Palestinians under its control the right to vote, if they remain permanently disenfranchised, Israel is no longer a democratic state. It becomes a copy of the South African regime. On the other hand, if it does grant them the franchise, then it ceases to be a Jewish state.
So if we take Ariel Sharon at his word that he wants to remove these settlements from Gaza, that he sees it in part as an answer to that demographic problem, I guess that would at least take a million-plus Palestinians out of the equation. What's the bigger picture he's headed toward then? Should we expect withdrawal from the West Bank as well, or a firmer line on the West Bank settlements?
Well, it's only a very temporary, short-term answer to the demographic problem and to the political problem as well. He may buy Israel something like, I don't know, 5 to 10 years, but then the problem will reassert itself. So the question is quite correctly, as you pose it, does he have an overall goal? Is he pulling out of Gaza in order to be able to resolve peacefully the overall conflict? I think given Sharon's record these past 20 years or so, one has reason to suspect that he is not pulling out of Gaza in order to make possible the emergence of a Palestinian state in the West Bank, but rather to prevent one, to prevent the emergence of such a state, because his calculation, one can surmise, is that the compromises he's prepared to make in Gaza will be seen as such a big deal that he will be relieved from the pressures he's been under to dismantle settlements and to make political progress on the West Bank.
Follow that line of thinking on through then. If that's the direction in which the prime minister's headed, the withdrawal from Gaza would be a first step What are steps 2, 3, and 4? The completion of the barrier? Is he imagining he can create a defensible wall between Israel and the Palestinians that includes part of what has been Palestinian territory in the West Bank? And then the Palestinians will simply have to live with what remains on the other side?
That is precisely what he thinks he can do, because otherwise one cannot explain why Israel is investing billions of shekels, a huge fortune given Israel's economic situation today, in this wall, if it is not to serve the purpose of enclosing a Palestinian population in less than half of the West Bank as the permanent arrangement that Israel wants to live with.
So if Israel withdraws from the Gaza Strip and puts up the big wall between itself and the bulk of the Palestinian population, does that solve the demographic problem you referred to?
You know, demography and politics go hand in hand. All it does, it seems to me, and I think to many observers, that if Israel were in fact to do that, and I shouldn't say Israel, I think most Israelis would feel very uncomfortable with this kind of an outcome. Mm. But there is a Likud constituency and a right-wing constituency that is even more extreme than a Likud that wants precisely that outcome, and that thinks that it can contain Palestinians behind those walls. But it's entirely predictable that if they were, in fact, to implement this plan, that there will be violence and terrorism and rage as far as the eye can see. This will not put an end to the conflict. It will only deepen it.
Henry Siegman, how do you see the United States playing in this new situation? Washington's not made strong statements yet about Prime Minister Sharon's comments on the Gaza Strip. Can Washington keep this corralled within the goal of a two-state solution, or has that been lost?
Well, Washington is the only country that can do that. The United States has always prided itself, and I think for good reason, that it can translate the good relations it has with Israel, this very special relationship, quite unique relationship between Israel and the United States, that it can translate that into an Israeli understanding, an Israel that would listen to Washington and make the necessary compromises that a peace agreement requires. Unfortunately, while we've come up with all kinds of plans to achieve this goal, from the Mitchell plan to the Zinni plan and to the Tenet proposals and now the roadmap, beyond offering these plans, when push came to shove and the United States had to lean on Israel to make sure, and on the Palestinians as well, of course, but it was uniquely with Israel that we have leverage that no one else has. We have not been willing to use that leverage. And if Gaza first becomes Gaza last, if the United States does not make it very clear at this point, this is a good thing, but only if it is a precursor to a second step, which is a withdrawal from the West Bank and the emergence of a viable Palestinian state there, then Gaza first can turn out to be an even bigger problem than we presently have, because there is a very high likelihood that in a Gaza that is isolated from the West Bank, it is the Hamas that will emerge as the ruling force.
It sounds like we have a lot more to watch and follow here. Henry Siegman, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
You're very welcome.
Henry Siegman joined us from Paris. He's director of the U.S. Middle East Project at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.